Ministry of Agriculture. Well, the Civil Service Commission again said, no, it's a rather low-grade department, because I'd come out pretty high in the exam, so I could always choose. And the Communist Party also said, we don't want you in the Ministry of Agriculture, you've been used to us there. Why not a great Department of State? And so I said, OK, Home Office. So they, it's very ironic, really, their views, their advice, coincided. Yeah. My father had been in the Home Office, and I knew a lot of people there.
Yeah.
And so it was going to be also a sort of cosy environment. And anyway, that's how I ended up.
So you were in the Home Office from when to when?
From 36 till I finally left the end of 47. I meant to stay for life, of course, because I was very keen that women should go into the civil service. Very few had gone in the upper grades, and I saw myself as a pioneer.
Yeah.
And I would certainly have stayed for life if, I hadn't met Herbert, and Herbert hadn't moved back to Oxford. But when he came back to Oxford as a don, I stayed on in London for 2 years, thinking I was still going to stay in the civil service for good. But then it was rather unsatisfactory living in two places, and I had to live in London. And I was then rather bored by the civil service. I thought I wasn't appreciated enough. And so I abandoned it, having arranged a job in Oxford, because I was always going to make it work. But to go back to my view of, I thought Herbert was rather frivolous about politics. And he and his friends were always making jokes against God, which, of course, I was an atheist, but even so, I thought that was not very, very necessary. And I remember going for a walk, and there was a man called Norman Brown. You should probably know him.
Yeah.
You know Norman Brown?
Yes, I know him.
He was a very close friend of mine. And he poo-pooed Herbert and that lot. Said they were very juvenile, going on about jokes against religion and more important things that you and I ought to be doing. So I didn't feel he was altogether a soulmate, because he wasn't especially committed about politics.
Yeah.
But he was moving.
When were you two married?
In war?
Well, I wasn't allowed to get married in the civil service. We came, as it were, man and wife in 37. I moved into his digs.
Mm-hmm.
So very uncomfortable. As a woman in the civil service, you weren't allowed to marry. But I finally got permission by chance in 1941, by which time I wasn't really certain I wanted to marry anyway. I thought it was the end of life and more independent and so on. But I decided I wanted to have a child, so I thought I'd better get married. And so I managed to get permission somehow. And so we married in 41. When Herbert and my father was born.
Right. Got in by Jennifer. Got in by Jennifer?
Yes.
This has never been revealed to Chapman Finch and all that, not to him.
You know, there's a libel, I don't know, a libel. Did you read it?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Jennifer, I gave a broadcast about being a communist, and then
which is totally misunderstood.
Totally misunderstood. Picked up by the Sunday Times, who produced a leading article saying, "Wife of MI5 man is KGB agent."
Says she is.
Says she
is. I was a Russian spy. Says wife of MI5 man. And did I actually
say this? And so we started a live action, but didn't pursue it. We produced a feeble apology, and I then became aware. The enormous risks of a libel action.
No.
But when I was in the civil service and the communist, they didn't know, they never asked you anything about politics, and there was no betting at that time. So I never told any lies about I guess me. And I became fairly disillusioned with it fairly soon, after about a year or so. And the strain was rather great, feeling I was double crossing. But no, I never actually did anything, because they never asked me to do anything.
The Communist Party never asked you to give them information?
No. They told me I got to wait for 10 years. I said this on the broadcast, which I was very relieved about. I got to get really accepted, join all the social clubs and that sort of thing, and get completely accepted and look fairly right-wing. So I wore a black hat and had a road umbrella and carried tie. But I used to have to go and see a contact every 3 months or something like that, who would ask me, or keep an eye on me.
Change to Texas.
But unfortunately, one of them was probably a KGB agent unknown to me.
Who was that?
Well, I don't know his name, because didn't have names.
It was a check.
Well, I got this vague impression, I don't know. MI5 have tried to make, they've shown me about 100 photographs and trying to make, so I really don't know. But I think I only met him about twice. And he was very fishy, he made one take taxis, get out of them, and took another taxi, so we followed.
When is this? Is this in the 30s?
Yes, late 30s. This would be 37, I think. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like this, really, because I saw myself as well, this rather idealistic person working for British, or going to work for British Communist Party somehow. Though I was always very doubtful about a lot of it.
What were you doubtful about?
Well, I was doubtful about, A, the morality of having a revolution, and secondly, the possibility.
And what about the trials?
Well, the trials, too, but of course we didn't know all about the trials, but we were worried about the trials. I remember having discussions with friends of mine who were left-wing, but not communist. And we were very worried and thought, well, perhaps we don't really know, perhaps it's better than it looks and that sort of thing. But no, I was worried about them. But there was a great deal to know that we didn't know. Maybe we could have discovered more. But I did have the world pulled over my eyes. I mean, I read the Webb's Soviet communism.
I wanted to switch briefly to you, at the risk of breaking this thread, to ask whether it is true, as your wife suggests, that you were essentially politicized by the deteriorating international situation in Europe in the 30s, or whether that's a kind of not how it happened.
Mixture. I mean, I felt that certainly the home, the spectacle of Nazis and fascism made me think a bit more about politics. But it was also, by this time, people like Jenny, who I'd been at Oxford with, had become Labour, and I talked to them. Mm-hmm. So, gradual process.
Yes.
But may I intervene now? Quite a lot of your friends and acquaintances at the bar were inevitably fairly right wing, weren't they? Well, I mean, people like Sparrow and Wilberforce.
They were, certainly, yes.
Mm. And so that, but I mean, you weren't, not that you were a right, interested in politics and right wing angle, but on the whole, they were fairly unpolitical, but if anything, or
yes,
right wing.
I knew nobody who was very active in politics at that time, except
two questions, again, of a certain grinding obviousness, but at what point as a Jew did you suddenly feel, boy, this is terrible, what's going on in Germany? This is really, this affects me. This
yes.
is a this is a menace. This is more than just a bad regime. This is...
Curious enough, Jay had done a lot of journalism. He was on the headline before he went to the Economist and been on the Times. And he did a lot about the Brown Book, which tried to get the English to see what horrors were going on would go on under the Nazis. And that appalled me. I didn't feel it was a personal menace. I was very unrealistic about the book. I somehow never felt it come, didn't particularly feel it would come home. I just felt terribly angry about people who were persecuted.
Second question is whether you can recall at any period in the 30s, at any time, discussions with Isaiah about what was happening in Soviet Russia.
No, I don't think I did. No. 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 You talk a lot about the Nazis as well. Mm-hmm.
But not about Soviet.
Not to me.
Well, then switch to
I
you.
I got the feeling that he was full of misgivings and apprehension about Russia, Soviet communism.
Yes. And at some point before lunch, you said it's to Isaiah that you owe the feeling that you ought to acquaint yourself with Marx.
Yes.
And your wife said, no, it didn't happen that early. It must have happened later.
Well, when it depends. I think I got onto it because Isaiah was writing with him.
Yes.
A book on Marx.
But he doesn't begin doing that until 33, 34, until after he's a fellow at All Souls.
I see.
Right.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about the trials and whether you can cast your mind back to 36, 37, 38. Did you read about them in the newspaper? Did you discuss them in the cell? Did you...
Well, I being a secret member, I never went to a cell.
You never went to a cell?
I wasn't allowed to. The moment they decided I was going to... It was decided I was going to go into civil service. Mm-hmm. I was not meant to have any contact with communists.
Right.
And that, from my point of view, was disappointing, because one of the attractions was to meet working class people on the basis of equality.
Yeah.
And so I was cut off. I discussed them with one's friends. I discussed them with my friends. We had a there was a group in the civil service which of left wing people. They were mostly older than me, and they had a club, and we used to read papers to each other. We called it the Ogpoo, it was a joke. Most of them weren't communists at all.
Yeah.
And amongst those sort of people, Andrew Cohen, they all did fairly well in the civil service. Amongst those sort of people, yes, we were worried. I think we didn't shut our eyes. I think we read about anything there was, but I'm not really clear how much there was in the British papers. Mm-hmm.
But you don't have a recollection of any moment when you thought, God, something really terrible is happening here. And here are, you know, old Bolsheviks, heroes of the revolution, mm-hmm. were being sacrificed.
Well, how soon was that known in England? Was it known before 38? Yes, I suppose it was. 37, yes. Mm. Well, one went on, I suppose, thinking that there must be some good reason for this, which we don't know. We didn't want to believe that the whole thing had gone wrong, I'm afraid.
Perhaps like Mrs. Weir, you can't make omelettes without breaking eggs.
Yeah. Some omelettes, some eggs, is all I can say. Yes.
Yes, but I mean, I there was no actual moment when I said I'm not a communist any longer. I just faded out. And certainly the trials and what's happened in Russia generally contributed to this.
Mm. When would you date your fading out?
No questions.
Yes, Herbert had some influence on this too, because when we were living together from 37 onwards, he thought I was pretty ridiculous and really mad. And I used to struggle trying to read the Handbook of Marxism, which I didn't altogether understand, and didn't much like a lot of it. And he punctured a good deal of this. Well, I would think I started weakening probably the end of 37, certainly in 38.
When you say punctured, what was it that you punctured, and how did you do it?
Theories of historical inevitability and so on.
And that
the whole lingo of the way in which the course of history is described.
Yes. But that's exactly Isaiah's line on those subjects.
Yes.
But it doesn't sound as if you get your line from Isaiah.
No, I don't think I did. I think it came through. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Yeah.
As I say, maybe, but I can't remember discussing much about communism with Isaiah before. Yeah.
Now, let's move into the war. One of you said either earlier that it was
it was
Jennifer who got the job in the MI5. Now what happened?
When the war came, I was on the officer's reserve. I was called up. They found I was not a mitral murmur, which is quite harmless, and they wouldn't take me.
Sorry, a murmur, a heart?
Yes. A heart murmur.
And so I had to go, I wound up my practice. I had to go back. And there I was, earning a lot of money, with all my friends away fighting or in the army or in jobs. I got determined to get out of it. I tried to get into this, that or the other. And then Jennifer was private secretary to the permanent head of the Home Office. And every day, the head of MI5 used to come to sit in our ante chamber, waiting to see the permanent head talk to Jennifer. And one day said to you know, a bright young man who would help us who can't get into the army. And he said, yes.
I do, actually. Yeah.
And so I got in, and within a week I was handling what I did, mainly did.
It was in a week after I'd mentioned his name, and they said, no checking up at all.
And within a week of that, I was handling what I did for most of the time I was there, in 5 years, the decodes, the German decodes for top secret.
Yeah.
And then...
Shows you how slack they were about
to. Then a terrific round broke out, because already when I was immersed in all this stuff and knew all the secrets, they discovered that I was living in Douglas Jay's house. Mm-hmm. And they had, madly, they'd got a warrant to open all letters going to that house.
Where I was living too.
What?
I said it's where I was living.
Yes, but
it was on Douglas.
It was on Douglas Jay.
Because Douglas Jay has a reputation for being kind of fire-eating, left-wing,
yes,
tribunite.
But I mean, he was tremendously, not only anti-communist, but anti-everything foreign. I mean, he's absolutely fantastic. And the last was an incredible patriot, I mean, terrific. And so hell broke loose when they discovered I didn't live there. But I managed to convince them. It was all rubbish.
Well, they first of all came to me and said, we like this man you recommended, he seems rather clever. And I said, yes, he's rather clever, I'm very clever. And they said, but is he all right? And I said, yes.
Good
yes.
person to ask.
It's unbelievable.
Anti-comedy, I never stopped laughing the whole time. But
they didn't. You're saying they didn't even know that you lived together?
No.
Did they not
know? No, of course not.
No, of course not.
And of course, I thought, I said, why are you asking this? And I think they said, well, isn't he living in Douglas Jay's house? Of course, I was living there, and I thought, oh God, they've got on to me. Though in a sense, I had nothing to hide, because I've never done anything, but still.
Who else are you working with in MI5 during the war?
Little, was the first time someone was like Guy Little, do you remember name? Mm-hmm.
Recently denounced.
Dick White, his great friend. I worked, I was his number two in all those sections. Dick White, Furnival Jones, who became head of the office later.
Anthony Blunt.
Anthony Blunt has shared my room for 3 years. I'd known him a bit before the war.
What impression did he make on you?
I was going to say that was one of the things this libelous article got hold of. Well, I mean, I knew he had been a communist, and was a communist still, I thought. I interested in his conversation about art, it's factually illuminating, very good art historian, I thought. He was cold fish, and I always felt that. Cold fish. He was very friendly, and I were both members of the Reform Club. I used to have lunch with him quite a lot. He wasn't the kind of person I very much liked, but I admired his eloquence and so on. Yeah. And I didn't think that he would do anything bad during the war. He defended, he attacked in conversation the government for not, MI5 and the government for not handing more secret information across to the Russians.
Yes.
Especially these decodes, which we managed to, we got, though it was now concern, all the communications about the Eastern Front. Yes. And it was quite plain to us that there was going to be an attack on Russia, a German attack on Russia.
Now, when did you get those? This is a intense interest to me for various reasons, because one of my uncles was in military intelligence and felt passionately.
In England?
Yes, and felt passionately that the Soviets weren't getting the information they needed. So I'm sympathetic to this.
Yes. Yeah,
but sort of May, April 41?
Oh, longer than that.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, we had the constant flow of this stuff, though not all. I was only responsible for those aspects of it which reflected on German secret activities, whether counter-espionage or espionage or sabotage. But mixed in with it all became a lot of stuff about the Eastern Front.
Yeah.
And there to explain to us.
And where is that traffic coming from? This radio traffic?
Radio traffic, certainly, yes. From to various outposts to Berlin. They had a network from Berlin all over occupied Europe and all over the occupied East.
Right.
And the messages would come back from the outposts. Mm-hmm. To
outposts being Poland?
Poland or the yes, certainly.
And the message are simply describing troop concentrations?
No, really concerned, because this was only it was only meant to be things about secret activities. They would describe the arrival or departure of agents and so on, but they would also say troop movements going on in the area or something.
Yeah. Yeah. How much of that did get to the Soviets before 41? Nothing, presumably.
Not as such. No, but what Anthony did was to try and hand it all out. And the great danger was that it would blow the source. I mean, the worst thing he did in the war was to endanger the source. After the war, the reason why I would find some difficulty shaking his head was that after the war, when he knew Spilby was at the top of the Secret Service, he kept him up, and Spilby was sending people to their death, British agents and so on.
Yeah.
And he knew all that, and said nothing. Yeah. Because he couldn't disclose that without disclosing himself.
Yeah.
However, that's the answer. Yeah.
Would it be true to say that when June 22nd, 1941 comes, the British intelligence community is, someone like you would have been taken nonetheless by surprise?
No,
you weren't?
No. We used to discuss with Dick White, is anything going to happen? No, when it broke, we were sitting in a garden in Jay's house in Hampstead on the Sunday.
Really?
Yes.
When did you hear it first?
Yeah.
On the wireless?
Yes.
Remember what time of the day? I'm sorry to go into this. This has nothing to do with Isaiah.
I remember sitting in the day. It must have been about midday, on the Sunday.
Yeah. Okay.
One other person you met in MI5 who has been quite important is Victor Rothschild.
Oh, yes. It's all Rothschild.
Yes.
And became friends. I'd known him, Victor, for them.
Yes.
And his wife, who was working with him. Tess
Rothschild.
Right. But she wasn't his wife then?
No.
Isaiah is in New York and then in Washington, occasionally back across the water.
Yes.
What contact do you have with him during the war?
I'll tell you a common story about it. Isaiah was in New York for a bit, yes, and then he went to Washington. And he rang us up and said, look, I'm coming home. I think this was in the winter of 1942. No, 1940, when the bombing was on. And he said, could you put me up? So we had this house. We lived in Douglas Jay's house in Washington.
Where was Douglas Jay's house? Just the address?
In Wellwalk.
Oh, Wellwalk.
Hampstead.
Right.
And Isaiah arrived, and marvelous seeing him, and so on. And he disclosed that his main reason for trying to stay with us is that he was feeling terrible guilt not being exposed to the bombing in Washington. And he was hoping for a good night's bombing, which he did. There was an air raid that night.
Oh, really?
And he gasped with relief. Ah! That's a true story.
I mean, how much was that serious and how much was that Isaiah being his usual funny self?
Self-caricaturing. He certainly felt uneasy about not sharing what he thought were our tribulations.
Well, I think a lot of people in America did, English people.
Yes.
Yeah.
He did, certainly. Mm. Certainly, that was serious.
Yeah.
But the gasp of relief at the bombing, I don't know.
Yeah. What did he talk about his war work with you during that visit in 42? Can you remember what he said about being
I think he let us know that he was writing these weekly things, which I then got hold of and had a constant supply of.
Yeah.
And in fact, they're good.
How did you get hold of them? I thought they were much more restricted. I mean, you were a senior chap. I don't mean to slight your eminence in business,
please.
But...
How did I get hold of you?
Perhaps he said it to you.
No, I think he was able to, I was able to ask them.
Yes.
And got it.
Yes.
In their mouth.
Yes. What did you like about them? Or what was good about them? Because they
have tremendous. Have you seen them at all?
I've seen the published edition.
They've been published, haven't they? Yes. Yes. I've gotten that. Mm. The personality is described, and the complexity of the political scene was all made intelligible. Yeah. And I thought they were wonderful.
Mm. They were so unlike usual. This is the property of HMV Company.
Was that the only visit you had with him during the war, the one in 42?
I doubt it.
I was trying to remember. I can't remember, honestly.
I can't remember any other occasion. That's stuck in my mind.
Yeah.
I think he telephoned to one of them, asked how I was. Just by his concern. So he was always really nice.
But you presumably know how often he came over.
I think I do if I look back at the tapes. I now can't remember. I seem to recollect two or three visits.
I mean, we probably saw him every time he came. I think he would have.
Yes.
But it's the 42 visit that you remember particularly.
Well, that just because of that. Yes, you see, seeing his parents around the corner.
Yes.
I think they'd gone in the country to know how the house.
They'd gone to Oxford.
He's gone to Oxford. Mm-hmm.
I meant to ask you that.
Oh, yes, of course.
We've got ahead of ourselves. Your parents come down from the north to London in 39. And so you meet his. They live close to Isaiah's parents.
They didn't know each other.
Oh, they didn't. Mm-hmm. But you meet Isaiah's parents. But in
had met them before.
Ah, but in what circumstances do you remember meeting them first?
Meeting who?
Isaiah's parents.
He asked me home. Isaiah asked me home. I think I probably met them in Isaiah's room in New College before the war, when they came up to see him.
Yes.
And then, when he was staying with his parents, and I can't remember whether this was during the war or immediately afterwards, I used to go and see him. He got ill once, and there was a girlfriend called De Bendham, and she was Mrs. Berlin was obviously very apprehensive. And I was
apprehensive of what?
In case he married her. Married out of the place.
Yes. What impression did both of them make on you?
Who? The old Berlin.
The old Berlin.
Well, she, as I say, she was a formalist Yiddish mama, but she was intelligent too. Mm-hmm. And
small?
Small and compact. One felt a lot of energy there. She fit in many ways like Isaiah. Mm. And I thought of a pretty tough intellect, I should have thought.
Yes.
Formidable makes her sound rather more aggressive than she was.
No, she was a bit of a snob. Unearthed the fact that my forebears came from, most of them from Poland. And before that, she said, of course, the Russian Jews are the real aristocrats. Poles were far less so, and I said, well, my
that's an interesting remark.
Yes.
Yeah. He was telling the story about the school report.
Oh, I see. Well, yes, when Isaiah got into trouble with Isaiah, because somebody else had published this and had it for me. And Isaiah said, well, I don't think it's true, but it was true. No, Mrs. Berlin said to me, Isaiah, when we first came to England from Riga, Isaiah was sent to, we lived in Sydney, and Isaiah was sent to, at the age of six, sent to a small Dane school. And the first day, he came home and said, Mama, I understand nothing, I should never do any, make any progress here. And she said, according to her, oh, you wait, my child, it will be all right. At the end of the term, his reports came. There was Isaiah top of English and everything else. And then she said to me, and I repeated this, but Isaiah, and then it was published by somebody who heard it from me. She said to me, Mr. Hart, she had a very strong, still Russian accent, Mr. Hart, My husband kept those reports in his office, in his safe, and then there was an air raid, and the safe and the office was destroyed. Can you tell me where I can get a state archive copy?
That's a wonderful sort of Russian remark.
Yeah. Take me off for this, and said, you told somebody what I have no reason to believe.
But you heard it. You stand by.
I couldn't have invented it.
Yes. Well, that's a story about immense filial piety and pride.
Yes.
I mean,
but she was very
proud. She was. Oh, right, absolutely, yes.
Yes.
And more apprehensive, I think, than somebody who was standing up.
Gentile. Yes. Now, when you come to their house, did you have the impression that you were going into a Jewish family?
Yes, somehow. Well, there were mezuzahs on the wall.
Yes.
But they were in
They were very Jewish.
They were in my father, even in my parents' house.
Yes. But no prayers, no.
Oh, I was there several times on Friday night.
For Passover?
No, Friday night.
Oh, right.
And there was grace, which I would usually say.
Yeah.
You see, he's always had a Seder night up here.
Yeah.
And I've attended many of those.
Yeah. What impression did Isaiah's father make on you?
Well, he was bubbly, excitable, something of Isaiah's volubility, fairly superficial, happy, rather, seemed to me, gay, obviously very affectionate to Isaiah, but more sort of airborne than I would have expected, less grave and so on.
What kind of couple were they? They're obviously radically different temperaments.
Yes, I think she had a kind of motherly attitude to him.
He wasn't an intellectual at all.
No, not at all. He's clever, bright, but not an intellectual.
Yeah. One of the surprises I found as Isaiah talks about them is that he's in some ways fonder of his father, actually more affectionate about his father, who he thinks of as a rather lightweight figure, but who he, I think, loves in a much more uncomplicated way than he... This mother, who's obviously a much more intense, dramatic influence on his life, but for whom he feels a good deal of much more ambivalence. I mean,
she's rather demanding.
Yes.
Which the father wasn't very.
My mother died, I was very fond of, shortly before his parents died, and I wrote to sympathize with her, so that I felt when my mother died, in a sense, the roof had blown off. And she said that she's got to find out for him. It went on about this, exposed to every wind and nothing at all to say, much more than I felt. He was obviously.
But she died very late, didn't she?
Yes.
Yes.
So he was already in his 50s when he's saying the roof is blown off.
Yes.
Some people have said he was sort of mother fixated. Did you ever feel that?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I never discussed her or his relations with him, with her. I don't know. I think he may have been bullied by her a bit.
But he never reacted against them in a sort of classical way. Yeah. He was always incredibly nice to them, spent a lot of holidays with them, although he was bored by them at times. I remember him saying
that. Well, not everybody reacts as you did to their parents.
It's very usual to go through a phase of
I didn't at all.
Reacting against your parents. Which I'm sure he never did at all.
There was no rebellion.
No, absolutely not. Yes. And he was very kind to them, though fed up at times, because they demanded to see him a great deal.
Yes.
And obviously wasn't terribly fulfilling in a way. Yeah.
Well, let's move forward, unless there's some other thing we should cover, to the sort of post-war period, to 45, 46. You come back and become a fellow... At New College.
That's right.
Teaching philosophy and jurisprudence.
No.
Just philosophy.
Just philosophy.
You become a tutor and you do revisions, do you do supervisions together?
No, all the thing we did together was in the summer term before the degree exams. It's common to get your pupils are in for the exam together for a weekly session in which you can discuss anything, they can raise anything, they don't have to write an essay, and they might also have a regular supervisions. But this was a thing we did together, and 2-hour sessions a week, and they were hilariously funny. And we used to take one concept each week, space 1 week, time the next, causation the next, responsibility the next. As I was very good at that, I mean, when it got away from detail, which he was at his happiest. And it did give lots of people a kind of stimulus in their last term.
But how did you operate in the same room? I mean, I think of you as complementary in certain ways, but very different. He takes up a lot of oxygen, as I mean.
Yes. Well,
when you're with him, what's it like to teach with him?
Well, this was not the regular teaching. Mm. It was a lot of different. It was open to anybody to raise any question. Who would like to ask the first question, I would say, and then we'd start off. Mm. Then one would chip in. Mm. And Isaiah was very good. He didn't dominate.
But, yeah, he never, I always thought that one of the differences between him and Maurice Barra, which there are many probably, was that if you started saying something, if you were talking to Isaiah, if he was talking, and you began saying something, he stops and just wants to hear what you're going to say. With Maurice, did you ever know Maurice Barra?
No.
This would stimulate him to shout you down even more. Don't you think that's true?
Yes.
Whereas, although Isaiah is a fantastic talker, as you probably know, if you begin saying something, he does stop and...
He's not a bad listener.
That's what I mean,
that's the surprise, yeah, I think that's
There's a certain tendency in his conversation to become a monologue. Mm.
Well, yes, but then that's partly one's own fault if one doesn't break in.
Yes.
But it was impossible to break in with Maurice.
Yes.
But you felt in your teaching, just to be clear, that it was fun teaching with him, that he didn't dominate, that you worked well as a...
Yes, certainly. Mm. He was losing the interest in philosophy, of course, rapidly, in technical philosophy, and this was...
Can you, from your side, account for that or explain how that happened?
No, except I now see that the kind of philosophy he might well have thought was totally thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wrote a great essay on what's called counterfactuals. Mm-hmm. If.
Yes.
Well, you might think that if is an exhaustible subject and wasn't much connected with great events.
Yeah.
And I felt that. Mm-hmm. And that nobody was doing the history of ideas in England, at least as it ought to be done.
Yeah.
And that he had a niche which actually was what he could fill. And it was too sterile and too narrow. He got excited over the early days of logical positivism as much to show its shortcomings as to welcome its positive contribution.
Yeah. Did you feel at that time that as you began to do your serious jurisprudential work that he was someone you could talk to?
No, I never worried. I thought he'd be bored. Just a distraction. I don't suppose he's read my books. No, I shouldn't have thought so. Mm. I should not.
So it's not an intellectual companionship outside those classes that you did together?
Not a scholarly companionship, no. I mean, in a sense, I suppose, what we talked about was ideas.
But not your ideas in your field?
No, I was much more interested in his work. Bentham, about whom I wrote a book of essays, would be a horror figure to myself. And of course, there's a lot to be horrified by. But no. I think that's right, that I don't really see. I did do things of this about, they're in the collection of mine called Essays in Philosophy and Jurisprudence. About liberty or freedom. I used to criticize his bits of his things on freedom.
Yes.
On essays on liberty.
Yes. You didn't like two concepts of liberty.
Oh, I liked it, but I thought it was things missing from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And
historical inevitability, didn't you think it was about that?
Yes, I thought that. I don't know what I thought about that.
This is again one of these questions of ignorance that I shouldn't come to so unprepared, but do you have on record in print disagreements with him about liberty?
No, never commented in print.
Can you recollect now what those disagreements were as say, Two Concepts of Liberty came out? What is it that seemed wrong to you about them?
Somehow that there was, he didn't sufficiently, in his account of negative liberty, liberty simply the absence of coercion, he didn't take into account that this might be quite worthless to people who were starving, and that you need to have an economic background filled in. Let's say those two, when I raised this kind of question, he said, well, that's not about liberty, that's about the value of liberty. And I said, you can't catch it this way. Mm. It's going to blind people to important things. That was the most.
Well, that's a fundamental disagreement with that. I mean, that's as fundamental a disagreement as you can have.
I don't remember pressing it much,
And that's also an agreement that shows up a fault line between your politics and his, surely.
Yes, I'm much more, I'm not very left-wing, but I'm more to the left in my life.
I mean, it's a bit like Mrs. Thatcher going on about how we're giving people choice. Freedom to give them choice.
Free to sleep, free to dine up a bridge.
Yes, free to sleep under a bridge.
That side of the criticism, I think, was he never really met. Mollheim wrote something about this, which was good, on his arm, criticizing this.
Are you going to see Richard Mollheim?
Oh, I'd like to, this is 46, 47, 48, 49. You moved back to
Oxford.
You moved to Oxford.
And 47.
How old are your children at this point?
They were born in 42, 44, and then 48 when I was born.
Right. Are you teaching, or are you...
Then?
Yes.
No, I first of all had I couldn't possibly offer myself as a teacher. I'd never done any... no one in those days wrote theses, as I did. No, I had a job in the extramural delegacy. A vaguely administrative job. It's called supervisor of studies. But I did start teaching quite soon, because I realised early on, very soon, that if you were in Oxford, the thing to do was to be an academic, because you didn't really count otherwise. And in any case, I was obviously interested in lots of things. And so I managed to get some teaching for the diploma in public and social administration, or one of these things, on the ground that I could teach about public administration. A place called Barnet House. So I slithered in like that.
Then you got a fellowship at...
I got a fellowship at Nuffield. I mean, do you want me to...
Well,
I did the extramural thing for 2 years. After I was there for a short time, it was quite enjoyable. There was a man called Thomas Hodgkin, who was head of it, who was a friend of mine. He was a communist instead. And he was covering the world with infiltrating communist tutors in a very interesting way, including Africa. And we got on very well, but he didn't think my heart was in the movement, which indeed it wasn't, because of various reasons. So I conceived the idea of, first of all, writing a book about the police for a series. It was a series called Time and Country. Because I'd been in the police section of the Home Office for 5 years, and I thought, well, there isn't a book on the police and how they're organised and running. So I used to leave the extramural delegacy at 5 o'clock sharp every day and migrate to the Bodleian and began writing this book, which gave me something to write on. And then I saw studentships at Nuffield advertised, and I thought, well, I'll have to get into one. So I was sent for by Norman Chester, who said, well, you're too old to be a student, would you like to be a fellow? So I said, yes, that's okay. So I was a fellow at Nuffield for a year or so, 2 years. A research fellow, of course.
What dates do you remember?
Yes, that was 50, 51. So, and then I built up teaching at Well, I was a lecturer at New College for a year because the whole thing was very scandalous. James Joel, who you're probably going to see,
yeah,
was a politics fellow there and was...
He'd been my pupil.
Well, he was going to go away for a term or so. I think he'd asked me already to do a class with him. I did a revision class with him. And on the strength of this, he was going to go away for a term. He said, would I take over the politics teaching at New College? Amazing. I was really not qualified to do it, but it was a fantastic experience. So for a year I taught politics there. And then I for another...
This is 51?
51, I suppose that was, yes. Or 51. And then the politics job at Exeter fell free because Norman Hunt, who had been appointed, had a nervous breakdown. I shouldn't say it. And so on the strength of saying I was a lecturer at New College, I got as a lecturer at, well, being a lecturer, you meant that you taught all their people. And so, on.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of teaching experience.
At Exeter.
At Exeter also. So I was extremely lucky because you jolly well learn and teach. But this was all modern history and politics. This was the history for, 19th century history. And then I picked up a little teaching from LMH in Somerville. And I wanted
been
to get...
At Somerville, so I'm graduate.
Yeah.
I wanted to get... wanted to become a tutor, obviously. But I didn't see how it would be possible because partly my qualifications weren't very good. And partly because you could only become a tutor in a women's college and there were very few jobs going, depending on someone dying or resigning.
Yeah.
So I was in slight despair. And because I was earning very much less, but we went badly off, but I was earning about a quarter of what I was earning for the service course,
yeah,
which with a growing family is useful, had good money. But then the history job fell vacant at St Anne's, the modern history job, in 1952, and a friend of mine.